Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the Stick to Wrestling podcast. I am John McAdam, along with my friend and co-host, Sean Goodwin. Sean, how are you doing this week?
Co-host as well. Why not? I'm doing well. How are you, John?
I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to our fourth podcast, you and I, the Lennon and McCartney of wrestling podcasters.
Indeed. Working
right,
with
so
the
what
great Brian Last.
Today?
So we were talking earlier, and I know, you know, the younger guys always kind of get sick of us talking about the greatness of the territories.
I don't think they get sick of it, but go ahead.
But I mean, you know, we'll kind of degrade the modern product for, you know, the old days. So what I was thinking was, now, it's often said that you can't, well, it hasn't been done yet, but can you start up a territory now?
No.
So you know, so that's what I wanted to explore, because I'm not exactly sure. I think it can be done. So the best way to probably start that is to look at somebody who's done this before, you, and kind of walk you through what you have to do. Like, I'm doing a startup wrestling business right now, a territory. What are the first things you got to do?
Well, let me backtrack a little bit. I actually, one of the things I like about you, you don't degrade the current product. You just say, yeah, I don't watch it, and that's the end of it. I personally don't like it when someone tells me how WWE sucks, why the current product sucks, and they haven't watched it in 20 years. Like, it's okay if you don't watch, but don't tell me what's wrong with it, you know? And you don't do that, and I think that's good.
It's different. I don't consider it the same thing.
Because it isn't.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So it would be like me sitting there, you know, talking about something entirely different and saying, well, I hate this because it's not this. Well, it's never meant to be, you know, what I'm thinking of as wrestling. And that's fine. You know.
The analogy I use is I love the old Rod Serling Twilight Zone series from the early 60s. Then
brilliant.
In the 80s, they put out a new Twilight Zone series. That, even though it is still technically the Twilight Zone, it sucked, and it's unwatchable, and it's not the same thing as the thing that I fell in love with. And I get
well,
that.
You know why?
Tell me.
Rod Serling wasn't writing it because he was dead.
That's a good reason to not be writing it.
I mean, there you go. I mean, Rod's a genius. That's why that show is so good. So.
I think you could redo the Twilight Zone because there are other good writers out there, but we're talking about Stick to Wrestling. I mean, it was just such a cheap ass, poorly produced, poorly acted, poorly written show. Everything was bad about it. Unlike the first one where it was just, you know, it was well acted, well produced, excellent writing and dialogue. But anyway, but I think that analogy holds up, and I get it. You know, if someone doesn't watch today and they watched, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago and they say, hey, man, it's not the same thing, I get it. It's not, you know?
But I think it could work today if you put it in the right spot and if you do it correctly. So that's why I was hoping you can kind of just walk us through what it's like. You know, what are the first things you have to do? I mean, obviously it's not just, okay, let me just book this. I mean, you have to, like, you know, get a hall, get insurance, whatever. What are the first things you do?
I mean, those are the biggest things. Number one, you have to find a venue that works for you. Number two, you have to find someone to produce the television, which is big, especially in this era. Number three, you have to hire a crew of wrestlers and referees and have a manager. You know, it's funny, when I did UCW, and it was a long time ago, 26 years, man, Cliff Ducey from the Boston Herald was actually nice enough to say, hey, this promotion is starting up. If you're a referee, a manager, or a wrestler, you know, this is the number to call. Get some work. And I got, maybe as a result of that ad, 5 responses from wrestlers. Maybe 10 responses from referees and people who wanted to be referees. And literally, I would say 70 to 80 responses from people who thought they could be managers. It's like, you know, it's just the easiest thing to do, be obnoxious on camera, and everyone thinks they can do it. But in reality, there are so many bad managers, and there are so few good managers. But
oh yeah,
so you have to you have to find someone who owns a ring, or if you want to buy one, you have to have a crew to set that ring up. I mean, there's a lot to it, and that's just the bare bones. You got to get it out there, and you know, once again, it's not 1992 anymore. I mean, you can put a wrestling show on the internet, but you're competing with so many other wrestling shows, and you're competing with WWE Network, and I'll get more on that later. So I just don't know, like, how you could distribute it. I mean, if you had a ton of money, let's say you had someone, hey, I'm a billionaire, I don't care if I burn through $5 million, my dream is to be a pro wrestling promoter. Okay, here's the advice I would give you. You know, you'd have to hire someone, I would think, to try to get your product on a decent network. And I don't mean, you know, that the last thing on DirecTV that no one watches. I mean, you know, a real distribution network. And you'd have to have it, again, available on a streaming app on the internet. And then you ask the question, well, how's this thing going to make money? I mean, you know, live ticket sales, well, that's a possibility. But first, you got to get your audience built up. I mean, Jim Cornette said rule of thumb was don't run a town until you've been on TV for at least 6 months, probably more like 12 months. And then once again, you get that competition factor. Someone could sit home and watch WWE Network for $10 a month, and there is plenty of current content out there. We're talking like NXT, the 205 division, etc. So it's a lot to compete with, and I think it would be – you'd have to say to yourself, okay, I'm never going to touch WWE, what they do, but if I can just be profitable in my own universe, that's a possibility. But once again, are we looking at, you know, getting rights fees from television stations, you know, meaning on cable? Are we selling a lot of merchandise? Are we selling a lot of tickets? I mean, to me, it looks like such an unbelievable uphill climb. But you have an idea, and I'd like to hear it.
Well, first of all, in this day and age, would you need a network?
Would you need to be like...
If you were able to establish yourself through a website or like some kind of a streaming service, could you get into big enough of a fan base? Because you don't need a huge fan base. I mean, you don't have to have... It's not like you have to fill out the garden, you know, Boston Garden or Madison Square Garden. I mean, you just need to, you know...
Yeah, I mean, if you could find a venue and you could sell 500 tickets and you kept your costs down enough, which, believe it or not, is at least it used to be kind of easy. I used to compare it to if you just started a band and you're playing in a Chinese restaurant, you're not making a lot of money. That's just the way it is. But I mean, beyond that, I see it as being difficult just putting something on the internet and getting enough people to watch it. I mean, it's not my area of expertise, but it doesn't sound like...
It would certainly be more difficult, but it would give you a larger buffer because you'll be saving the money on getting the network space. So that's going to stretch out the amount of time, you know, by cutting your cost down that way. So yeah, it certainly is a gamble trying it that way. But I'm just looking at the fact that you don't need a million followers. If you get 10,000, I mean, you know, that's outstanding, especially if they're in the area. The other reason I was thinking of is because one of the negatives, the one of the things you look back fondly of the territories is each one was different.
Yes.
It wasn't the same product. You know, what was going on in Memphis was certainly different than what was going on in Florida. Or Portland.
Totally. My favorite thing about the territories is when a wrestler got stale, he moved to another territory and he could start over somewhere else.
So but the benefit of the territories was you could cater to your local audience. Now, let's take a look at the two territories that really kind of, you know, the post-boom era that really were the most successful, which would be ECW and Smoky Mountain. Fair enough?
Yeah, I totally agree.
Smoky Mountain, I think, basically gave you the blueprint. The one problem with Smoky Mountain was the one benefit of Smoky Mountain, the area. Granted, there was a passionate fan base there. They were going to show up if you gave an honest product. But all you need is the coal industry to slip a little bit in that area. There's not a lot of disposable income there.
Right.
So you could run into, much like Mid-South did at one point, you can run into problems outside of your control. So you could be putting on the greatest product ever and it won't matter. That was really the only problem, and it eventually ended up getting them.
Well, I mean, Mid-South had other problems.
Mid-South did, yes.
Yeah, I mean, when it's funny, when people are broke, they find the disposable income as a way to escape. I mean, when we as a nation are at our poorest, the movies do the best because we go out and watch movies instead of going on vacation, but we do something.
So you can pick anywhere to start a territory. The first thing I would look at is, because this is the one thing, is it's not going to work everywhere. You got to pick your spot. And I think being able to cater to that area, that audience, that will make you different from the national product automatically. And they may, you know, provide an alternative. There's where ECW ran into trouble. Because when they went national, they tried to almost, you know, the product in 95 was much more interesting than the product later on. Because it was a little bit of everything. They would try different things. The interviews were just off. I mean, because they were catering to a certain audience. Once they tried to expand it, to be honest with you, as crazy and bloody as it got, it got predictable.
No, I agree with that. I mean, and I think they went after the, you know, a specific market, which is Philadelphia, which at the time was wrestling crazy. And they were starved for the old days of the NWA and, you know, and whatever else. So you're right. That's when ECW was at its best. But you're right. At some point, the stuff that, oh, my God, it's so hardcore, I've never seen it before. Okay, now I've seen it twice, 5 times, 10 times, and, you know, starts swirling down the drain.
Because that wasn't the way it was in the early days. I mean, the early days. You know, like when it just started, 94, 95, 96. You would have, you know, Lucha, you know, which was, you never saw back then. You know, the high-flying stuff. You would see, like, straight, you know, Malenko-Guerrero wrestling matches. I mean, the brawling was basically limited to the guys who you looked at like, well, what else are they going to do with them?
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, Axel Rotten or Ian Rotten and those guys. Or, you know, Public Enemy. Well, what else are you going to do? I mean, you have to play them that way. But it wasn't every match. You know, it was a little something different each match. And that really worked for, as you said, Philly fans who appreciated the wrestling. They will boo if you give them a bad show.
That is true. And you know what, though? I think ECW, in a lot of ways, a couple of things. Number one, I don't obviously have access to their books. I just wonder if at any point that thing was making money. I mean, I'm not talking about like one show one day. I'm talking, you know, quarterlies, monthlies, however you want to look at it. I got to wonder if it was ever in the black. You know, again, I have no way of knowing, but I kind of doubt it because they were spending so much money bringing guys in.
That, and also the guy running it was the worst businessman in the history of the world. I mean, there's a running joke. I mean, that's kind of one that you ask any of them, and they'll tell you how bad he is. You know, Paul Heyman. I think if they had a business that was run, if he had somebody, you know, just to handle the books, they would have made money in the early days. They should have, at least. But again, they once finally, as you're saying, that's when they overexpanded themselves, because even the guys they were bringing in were unknown. They became known in ECW. No one knew who Chris Benoit, Malenko, and Guerrero were.
I think some of the more hardcore fans that showed up, the guys who, you know, sat by their mailbox on Saturdays waiting for the mailman to show up and give them their Observer, they knew who those guys were. And again, that was the audience they were catering to.
That was the audience. Right. They had a very specific – once they expanded off of that, though, that's when the product started to die.
Well, look at it this way. Chris Jericho was there, I want to say, correct me if I'm wrong, like late 94, early 95?
No, after that. He would have been there, I think, early 96 through mid 96. He was certainly gone by Barely Legal.
Okay. All right, then. You're correct. Chris Jericho, in his first book, has an anecdote about how, you know, they flew him in from wherever, and he gets to the airport, and Paulie has booked a bereavement flight for him. And Jericho in his book is like, oh my God, I can get arrested for this. But those were the things they were doing to save money because they were losing money. And
yeah.
I mean, like I said, if ECW couldn't make money in the 90s, I just question what could make money in 2018.
I think if you had anybody who knew how to read a spreadsheet in ECW, they're making money in 95. They were business incompetents who were running it. I mean, that's your problem right there. I don't think they haven't made money because I don't, you know, it's like one of those old, you know, the guy who has like, you know, the old athlete who would have like $10,000 checks just hanging around because they never thought to, you know, deposit them or something like that. Plus, Paul's got like a million unnecessary lawsuits. You know, just because it's really that important to go smash into the guy's car in the parking lot. I mean, really, come on.
Yeah.
So, but once he left that, but it worked until he moved on. And Jim Cornette, what he was doing, also worked until the economy started to slip on them. I think it still could work because you can do what they can't do. Because WWE cannot cater to your audience. They just can't. They have to, they have a national audience. They can't. So you can cater to your audience. So, okay, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. One thing about Smoky Mountain Wrestling, their motto was wrestling the way it used to be and wrestling the way you like it. Now, we're going back over 25 years before Smoky Mountain Wrestling started. The people who wrestling the way it used to be, those people that would pertain to are now very old. I mean, Memphis Wrestling, you know, kind of hit the skids well over 30 years ago. And I think those people are kind of used to wrestling no longer being in their lives. I mean, I just don't see that person who's like, wow, I had so much fun at the Knoxville Civic Center in 1978 when I got to see Ronnie Garvin and the Mongolian Stomper or whoever. Like those people, I mean, not to be morbid, a lot of them are no longer with us. And
yes, but some of them also are grandfathers now. Who tell their kids like, oh, gee, no, too bad you weren't there back then. You know, so you still have people. I still think there's an audience for specific types of products. Okay, but you're right. It has to be in a certain area. For example, I'd say the right area would be, what were the last towns to hold out? The last towns to hold out against Vince. Memphis.
Memphis, technically, but I mean,
Portland.
They were still running on fumes by mid-90s.
True, but Portland.
Portland, I think, officially hit the pavement in 91.
So that would have been longer. Probably one of the Texas organizations, but they were really on fumes by then.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
But take someplace like Western Tennessee then.
Okay.
You don't think you would be able to cater a product for that area?
I am inclined to think no. Okay, let's take a step back. It depends on what you want to do. If you are someone who wants to have a hobby of running a minor league wrestling promotion in the Memphis area and just, you know that's all it is, it's minor league wrestling. And by the way, how many times have people tried to bring back the Memphis wrestling? It's been done over and over again, and I'm thinking their old audience is, they're jaded. They've, tried.
And each time they brought it back, they were WWF light.
Yes, that is also true.
Mistake they all make.
And that's going back 25, 30 years.
They're either ECW light or they're WWF light. They're not catering to their audience.
But I mean, ECW borrowed a ton from the old Memphis shows.
Sure. Absolutely.
So now, but I think people would look at it as ECW light. Like I said, I genuinely think that your ceiling, if you want to do something like this, is it's a hobby. It's something I do because I enjoy it, and it's minor league, and I'm okay with that.
Oh, that would be important, though. You would want to have some kind of a boundary as to what you were doing. You would want to have, because that's what ECW didn't do. Smoky Mountain tried to do it, but again, they just the you know floor kind of fell in on them. But you know that when ECW, you would need to have kind of a this is what we are. We're the local, and I think that would be part of the selling point. We are the local guys. Even this is when did Georgia start going downhill?
Like late 82.
Yeah, right when they started to emphasize the national title.
That yeah, the national title came in, I want to say, end of 1980.
Yeah, but it was always the Georgia was kind of both of them were right there. It was by 82, I think Superstar had the belt, and they started emphasizing the national belt, and it became more of a national product.
Yeah, that's true. They introduced, if I recall correctly, they had the national championship tournament in Atlanta, like November, December 1980, and Terry Gordy beat Jack Briscoe in the finals. But that's the thing. They're on WTBS, and they, you know, I'm thinking they're planning on expanding nationally at some point. And, you know, I didn't mind it, but I could see other people just saying, okay, this guy's the Georgia heavyweight champion, and I'm
you weren't from Georgia
in Los Angeles.
You weren't from Georgia.
No,
if you're a local Georgia fan, but I'm saying if you're a local Georgia fan and all of a sudden they're doing more of kind of this national WWF style of wrestling, I could see that you would be annoyed by that.
So you're saying that you would go after the audience, and I can see this because I liked it too as someone who watched WTBS from far away. I embraced a Georgia championship belt, and that's what you'd be going for. You'd be going for.
Yep.
Okay, I mean.
Yep, you would sell the local belt because that's why Memphis held on for so long, because they kind of held to that credo. This is what we are, and you. But again, once they started kind of bringing in the WWF, basically like a minor league for the WWF, that's when they ran into problems again.
I think the only reason that Memphis lasted as long as they did was because they had that television time spot, and because they had it so long, it was a habit of people to tune in at 11 o'clock on Saturday morning, and that was there. That was the one thing that they had, and even towards the end, you know, WMC is like, okay, this is no longer doing ratings. It's gone.
But I will go up until, and no one loves Memphis more than me. I love Memphis. But I really, and you had to talk me into it, was the Bill Dundee angle with the Bill and Buddy show.
Ah.
That's as late as I'll go. I will not go after that. I can't do it. That's when, to me, it starts to kind of start to get a national feel to it. 83 was like that, too. And I don't like 83 either. They kind of had the national feel, but if they stuck to their core audience, their core beliefs, they did well. And that was the same with ECW. I mean, again, Smoky Mountain was kind of a special case. That was the same in Portland. Portland did their own thing. I mean, if you've ever seen a Portland show, that's completely different.
Yes, it is.
I
mean, a couple of quick notes on you know, both Memphis and Smoky Mountain. I mean, Memphis, you had that built-in audience for so long. And I mean, the Memphis, I forget what the exact ratings were at its peak. Do you happen to know off the top of your head?
Oh,
it was,
God.
It was spectacular.
It was like 70, I think. It was something.
Yeah,
it was one of those things I had to look up later, like, that can't possibly be right.
Right.
That's
got to
be different.
This guy hit 110 home runs in a season, and you're like, yeah,
yeah,
right.
it's
kind of the equivalent. But
for several years, it was the highest rated local television show in the country.
Okay, and I totally believe that. But here's the thing. You have that built-in audience, and over the years, that audience began to erode. And so you had that built-in advantage, and it's still at the end of the day that show was canceled. Now you're starting from scratch.
But see, and I think because of the internet, because of camera equipment, I think this can be done much cheaper. That's where I think your window is, because you're going to have because back in the day, say back in 90, okay, how much you got to rent an arena? What arena are you using for your organization?
For Memphis, they ran the Mid-South Coliseum.
Oh, I know that. I mean, for you, when you ran the local, you know, you ran your territory. What arena did you use? What place?
It was called the St. Stan's, it was a hall, St. Stanislaus something or other, but I don't know if it was, they called it an arena or a hall, but it is now a Korean church. But anyway, and it cost $500 every time we rented it.
Okay, so you have that. How much was your time slot?
For television?
Yeah.
We never got that far. We shot the tape around and no one wanted it.
Okay. Well, how much was okay? What was your expense for the production of the shot of the show?
This is absolutely fantastic. It was zero, and the reason it was zero is because my friend Jody Boynes had a friend named Paul who worked at a local public access cable place. And this was far away. This was in Marshfield, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And this guy had like the overnight shift. So I could go down to Marshfield, show up at this cable access place at like 10 o'clock at night. And he and I would shoot until like 4 a.m. when I'm like, okay, I need to get home before traffic kicks in. And usually we'd be able to do, we taped every 3 weeks, and usually I would have to make 2 trips down there to get 3 weeks produced. But it was free, so you can't complain too much.
You're a regular Kevin Smith, aren't you? okay, so that killed my point. But my point is that today you can get camera equipment and that kind of, you know, and make a quality product for much less money than it normally would cost back then.
That is absolutely true.
I mean, the stuff is just cheaper. You can produce it. I have editing equipment on my computer where I could do it. Back then, you had to buy all this stuff to take care of it, or you had to rent a bay.
Yeah, so. I mean, you know, that's clearly an advantage. You know, and that's good. The problem is, once again, you know, where's the money going to come from? Are you really going to be able to sell, you know, thousands, if not hundreds, of tickets for a wrestling show, a local wrestling show, when all you have to do is tune in USA Network and see the biggest names on the planet for free? I'm not saying it's impossible, but man, I'm thinking this is an uphill climb.
Oh, of course it's going to be an uphill climb, but see, you're looking at it the wrong way when you're sitting there like, that's the important thing. When you're saying, well, why would I want to watch these guys if the biggest star? No, you're not them. You have to emphasize you're not them. I mean, you have to be as ridiculous as Paul was. But I mean, he had the right idea, though. I mean, granted, he had to like go way over the line about it. But he had the right idea of keep emphasizing that we're the alternative. You know,
yeah,
we're
you
not
know
them.
What I think happens and what I think becomes inevitable is, you know, you do the product differentiation thing, which totally makes sense, obviously. What that's going to be, I don't know. That's another issue. But then here's what happened to Smoky Mountain. Here's what happened to ECW. If you're going to watch, if you live in Johnson City, Tennessee, and you go to, and you're a Smoky Mountain fan, you go to the shows, well, you're also watching WWF TV. And I truly believe in this. When you see the heavenly bodies who dominated Smoky Mountain Wrestling, and they go to the WWF and they're like one of the bottom tag teams, which they shouldn't have been, but they were. It just underlines that Smoky Mountain Wrestling is minor league. When WWF snags Taz, who had the whole promotion fed to him, when they snag him from ECW and he comes to the WWF and he's an underneath guy, I mean, it really makes your promotion look minor league. Now, would I embrace a good minor league wrestling promotion? Yes, I would. Are there enough of me to go around to support it? I have to question that.
You're selling it the wrong way again now. What I would say, if I have someone, say the Heavenly Bodies or Taz or Public Enemy is another good example I'd like to use. My argument, if I see that, is I come back and say, they don't get it. They're not as smart as you. You understand wrestling. And again, you're emphasizing the difference. This
now,
is something different.
The counter to this is, and I could throw this one out, is probably every fall Saturday on about 30 different stadiums are sold out. And when I say sold out, I mean from 70,000 to 105,000 fans are out seeing what is basically minor league football. But it's not exactly the same thing.
No, but again, they don't emphasize. Okay, I'll give you a. Okay, I would say 1985, no one ever heard of the UMass basketball team. I have a point with this. No one ever heard of the UMass basketball team, okay? That changed when Calipari showed up. What did he do? He did one specific thing that got him national attention.
He won.
Before then, he was taking up the midnight time slot. He was the guy who invented that.
Ah, okay.
And that started giving them a kind of almost a cult following because they were always on the midnight game. And it became a thing with the old Curry Hicks Cage because all the fans got into it. So it was something different and they started building a following that way. I think, if you did a show with, let's say, the local talent, how much would the show cost just for the talent?
Oh, I mean, I would say you would have to find a crew of guys and you would need to fill out a card. I would say you would need at least 14 wrestlers and bare minimum as a pittance for their gas money and whatever, you'd have to give them at least $50 each. And that's bottom of the barrel pay.
Okay, so bump that up a little bit, say 900. So I'll just make these. Okay, say 1,500. So you're at 1,500. Okay. What other expenses do you have for a show?
You have to rent a ring. You have to have insurance.
Insurance. How much?
Oh, insurance is a crippler. Especially, you know what? It was a crippler in '92. Can you imagine what it's like today?
How much was it in '92?
It was $300 a show, and it was like for five shows. We got like a discount because we bought enough for five shows.
Okay, so you're probably looking at today $800.
I don't think an inflation calculator will do it because I'll bet the insurance is just more nowadays. Especially for a wrestling event. I bet it would be over $1,000.
Okay, so say $1,200, and how much for the ring?
I would say probably, it depends on your luck finding someone, but I'm going to guess you could get a ring if someone's not too far away from like $400 a night.
Okay, so say give or take around $3,000 for a show. Okay.
Okay.
Now you've got advertising. Yeah, you can. I mean, you can be. I mean, you can do that cheap though if you're talking about a local show. I mean, you buy an ad in the pay. You can buy an ad on one of a couple of local websites. You're probably talking a couple $100. Okay, that wouldn't be insane.
I question how effective that might be, but all right.
You're not looking. You're trying to keep your costs as low as possible because you don't need a huge crowd. All you need, if you can draw 500 to 1,000 within, but that's what I'm trying to figure out. So if you're talking 3,000 a show, you really don't have to say if you could get like start off with like $20,000. You could fill enough to give yourself 7 or 8 shows that you could put on that you could try to produce together, put on the internet, and that gives you kind of a lag time to build into a show.
Yeah, the problem
I'm saying it'd be done for a lot less.
I mean, the problem is, you say, okay, well, if you can get 500 or 1,000 people, I mean, that's tough.
Oh, I know it is. But you can do more of a targeted marketing to do that, though. Because if you look at the area, say you start in Philadelphia. And again, this has to be done. This isn't going to work in Boston. It's just not going to happen. Okay. I'm looking at Philly, Portland, the Carolinas. Maybe parts of Texas, any place else I'm thinking of, I'm missing that are kind of that hardcore
wrestling
town.
I can think of.
Carolina's, you know, in that area. But you have to, yeah, you would have to absolutely pick the right area. But I'm sitting there thinking that, you know, how much would it have cost you back in the day to produce 7 or 8 shows?
I mean, everything all told, I'm going to guess right around probably, I mean, let's say on average, like for everything, including the product itself, let's go with $1,000 a show.
Okay. I'm just saying that with the if you can promote it correctly and don't, like, because you keep saying it's you know, it's hard to get 5 of 1,000. It's not hard to get five. Well, it is hard to get 500,000. But if you're targeting those 500 to 1,000, if you're looking for a group, you know, that this is what they want to see, and you make it for them, so it's going to be a smaller window, but you can target right for them. That's what you can do with the territory today that you can't do on a national level. That's why I keep saying emphasize the difference in the two.
Yeah, I mean, another one of my concerns is that every area that you mentioned, I mean, how many promotions have tried to, you know, rise from the ashes of ECW in Philadelphia? I mean, if you're a fan, let's say you were a big fan of ECW, you loved ECW. How many times has someone tried to reproduce ECW and sometimes not particularly well? You know, so
well, here's the irony of that. Here's the irony of that, though, is that when they reproduce ECW, they reproduce the ECW that when it started to die.
Yeah.
They didn't reproduce the ECW that made it successful. In back in 94, 95. That was the product that made them successful. It's when they already became successful and they started doing the crazy stuff. That's the part that everyone impersonates, and that's when everyone left or started to leave.
Yeah, you know, one thing, too, we're talking about ECW. I think the best thing Paul Heyman did, and he kind of lost his ability to do this, but the most important thing, he went out there with guys that no one cared about. No one cared about Taz. I mean, he was the Taz maniac, and then they shored up his gimmick. No one cared about Tommy Dreamer. No one cared about Sabu, etc., but Shane Douglas, to a lesser extent, at least he had been on WWF now in WCW. But again, he totally rebuilt Shane Douglas. He created these characters, and he got the people to care about them, either to love them, hate them, or whatever. And that to me was the best thing that he did. And to me, that's the hardest part. You have to get the people to care about these guys you're rolling out there that they've never seen before.
Those characters were catered for the Philadelphia, New York area. Look at Taz. I mean, that is like the perfect Philadelphia, New York character.
Yes.
As far as wrestling goes.
Yeah,
you know,
Heyman had the smarts to be able to create that character, to have the guy who used to be the Taz maniac, all of a sudden this guy is like an amateur wrestling champion with a crew cut, and it worked. But it's not as easy as it sounds, I think.
No, it's not easy, but you have to be committed to it. Okay, why does Colin Kaepernick, politics aside, what is the official reason why he does not have a job?
Because he's too controversial.
There's that, and there's also the fact that you have to redesign your offense to suit what he does. I mean, it's not just to bring him in and have him drop back and throw. He doesn't work well in that system. You got to have him, you know, bootleg, whatever else like that. The reason I bring that up is that Taz can work, but you have to be committed to Taz. I mean, yeah, you know, you have to actually go along with it. The WWF, like, they started when they brought him in, but they kind of faded off that. I think Paul summed him up perfectly. He's the big fight guy.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, it's like I said, Heyman got, I don't want to say lucky, but luck has something to do with it a few times with a few of his different characters. Here's the thing about booking. It's tough because a promoter comes up with what he thinks is a good idea. And will the fans embrace it? If they do not embrace it, what do you do? Do you scale back? Do you drop the idea? Or do you push it harder? And you would be surprised, or I guess a lot of people would be surprised if you look back, how many times a failing act got just pushed way harder, and sometimes it worked. The WWF 20 years ago basically said, look, we're going to push Paul Triple H until he gets over. He's either getting over or we're going to die trying. And at first, Triple H really didn't get over, and they just didn't stop. They were committed to the guy. At the same time, best example I can throw out there, Brickhouse Brown in Memphis in 1987, they made him the lead heel, and it wasn't working out. And the promotion just like doubled down on this guy. They gave him a huge stable. They gave him a ton of TV time, and it still didn't get over. And you just don't know if it's just that you're not pushing a guy hard enough, or if it's a bad idea until you've invested too much in him sometimes.
That is also a benefit you have as a local organization, because you know that Shane Douglas is going to be Dean Douglas in New York and not the franchise. You know, the Heavenly Bodies are going to be some job and tag team, not the Heavenly Bodies. I mean, that was the name, but I mean, they didn't have that, you know, the great tag team. You know, I think, weren't they advertised as the world's greatest tag team? In Smoky Mountain, I think.
You know what? I don't even remember, but I do remember them just totally not getting a push in the WWF. I was excited to see them brought in. I figured, okay, well, they'll get a run with the tag team titles. It'll be great. And WWF was like, they had no interest in pushing those guys.
But you can do more things because they only have so many spots. I mean, there's just so much you can do. You can't push everyone to the moon. So you can bring in. That's why Shane kept coming back. I mean, I can't stand Shane Douglas. I just can't. I don't mean like, oh, I mean like X-Pac. I can't stand him. Oh, just the pompous interviews. And, oh, God, he was injured for a year and a half. And he had the belt the whole time. The whole time. I think there were like two matches. One was with Al Snow. And that was a great match. It was a big hole in the center of the ring.
Yeah.
If you emphasize the difference, you can do stuff with guys that just for the opportunity is going to make it appealing to bring in guys. So you could do the reverse, that the guys are on the national television, but they don't know what they're doing. Watch what we do.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was trying to do in 92. And here's the thing. Out here, you know, we ran the shows in Nashua. Nashua had never seen anything that resembled Mid-South wrestling. I threw a bunch of that in there. They never saw anything that resembled Memphis wrestling. Threw a bunch of Memphis-type stuff in there. They had never seen anything from Japan, whether it be New Japan or FMW. They got some of that. I think now, in the 90s, the WWF totally did a Memphis-type program. They totally did a Mid-South-type program, and they did it with a ton of, let's be honest, Jerry Springer kind of stuff thrown in there. What I'm saying is, in 92, it hadn't been done before. In 98, it had all been done before on national TV, and everyone saw it. So you've got that working against you as well.
Well, but the stuff that hasn't been done, or the stuff that's been done, but hasn't been for so many years that it could work, because what did I think it was Bill Eadie, but he gave the great definition of what a great promo is. He said, do the opposite of what everyone else does.
Sure. Heyman had a great line. He goes, how do you make a woman stand out in a room full of blondes? Bring in a brunette.
Exactly. If everyone's yelling, you talk quiet. If everyone's talking quiet, you yell. Now it seems quaint, but something like a Smoky Mountain would almost be revolutionary now, because it's been so long.
Well,
when they try it, they do ECW. And again, the thing that cracks me up about that is they do the ECW when they started to fail.
You know, another thing that, you know, I hate to be negative Nancy over here.
No, I like a devil's advocate.
All right. One thing that we liked about Smoky Mountain, you know what, one thing we really liked about ECW, it was an hour-long television show, and this is ECW at its peak, where you had an hour of action and an hour of interviews, an hour of angles. There was no filler, or at least not a lot of filler. To a lesser extent, Smoky Mountain. Smoky Mountain had a ton of squash matches, but they also had a bunch of storylines going on, and every television show had an angle. Back then, and we're looking at, like, let's go 93, 94, you could watch an entire episode of WCW's, you know, 605 show, and they wouldn't do an angle. It would just be nothing but squash matches and interviews. WWF was the same way. They would just run squash matches and interviews. Now you have, you know, we're accustomed to having a television show where there's, I mean, I don't want to say no filler, but everything, at least in theory, means something, which is what made ECW and Smokey stand out. Now WWF does that the whole time.
No, they don't. What are you talking about? How does every Raw show start?
Usually with a talking segment.
That's a nice way to put it. A talking segment, yes. A half hour soliloquy, usually. Okay, that is not exactly what I would go for with Action Packed. Okay, when ECW was rolling and they were hot, and this was the smart move, because the reason it was so fast is because you can't roll Rocco Rock out there for 15 minutes. I mean, come on! Rocco Rock works well in nice 45-second segments. That's why when you put him anyplace else, it didn't work. You had to use him right. And same with the other guys. You use them, so in, it became fast-moving out of necessity. Because you guys just weren't good enough to go, I mean, oh, God. Have you ever seen the three-way dance? With Funk,
yeah.
Douglas, stop it with the greatest match in Western civilization with that. talk about three guys who shouldn't be going an hour.
I don't hate that match. And I think one of the things that they did that really got that whole thing over was the post-match shenanigans. With first Heyman, you know, screaming and walking out with Sabu, and then, I mean, like him or not, that Shane Douglas Terry Funk confrontation was really good.
Yes, I blew your knee to obliquity. I believe that was the line. Yeah, it was a brilliant Stephen. You know, it's, you know, Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln all over again. Douglas is an idiot. I don't get it. I didn't get it then. I don't get it now. I mean, the only thing he really has going for him is he's so inherently obnoxious that it's just you have to hate him.
I don't know if I ever told this story on this show before. I looked at Shane Douglas when he first started. He did a little bit in Bill Watts' promotion right before Crockett, right after Crockett took over, but he didn't last there. Then he went on. The next time I saw him was in Southeast Continental in 1988, and there was something about him. I saw something in him. Then when WCW brought him in 89, I saw the same thing. I'm like, this guy has potential. I don't know what it is, but I see it in him. Even though, you know, his matches, as were booked out of his hands, you know, the Dynamic Dudes was arm drag, drop kick, arm drag. I just got a sense he could be more than that. Then he came to the WWF 1990. They didn't do anything with him, but I saw he had charisma. Well, I was out. I was actually on the beach with someone who's in the business. And I told him, I'm like, I see potential in this Shane Douglas guy. And the guy said to me, forget it, he's an asshole. Just like that.
Well, it comes across.
I guess in real life, Shane has a thing where he can turn the wrong people off. I mean, Ric Flair did not like him. Arn Anderson did not like him. Jim Cornette did not like him.
I can see why, but again, that's he is a perfect. I even hate saying it. He is a perfect heel for Philadelphia. Plus, and this is the part that everyone forgets when they bring up Shane. When was Shane's most infamous moment in wrestling before he came to ECW?
Oh, his most infamous moment.
Uh huh.
Are we referring to him complaining to Jim Herd?
No, I'm talking in real, like in like actual wrestling in the ring. When him and Johnny Ace got booed out of Philadelphia, when they were supposed to be the baby faces.
I was at that show, and television does not do the booing justice. These people wanted Shane and Johnny dead.
You know, Paul's no fool. Actually, wasn't Paul there?
Yes.
Yeah. No wonder he uses Shane as his heel in Philadelphia.
You know, you're right, and I never thought of it that way. But, and I look at Shane, you have the average person who looks at Shane Douglas, someone who is, I don't know, a little bit detached from the business. They think they know what the business is, but they don't.
Me.
No, not you. I'm talking about a guy like Jim Herd, for example. He would look at Shane Douglas, and he'd be like, all right, we've got this good-looking, muscular blonde kid. We're going to make him a baby face. We're going to give him a skateboard. We're going to make him a dynamic dude. I can, you know, you and I could have told anyone right away that's not going to work. But what does Shane, what did Paulie do? He takes the good-looking blonde guy and he makes him the bad guy. And he emphasizes that he's from Pittsburgh and he does all this, nasty stuff, and Paul used him correctly. I have always said that if you had given me Tom Zenk in 1989 and I just got to book his stuff and Tom did whatever I said, I would have made millions off that guy. Because you look at him, he's a former Mr. Minnesota bodybuilder. He has GQ looks. Oh, let's make him a baby face.
Oh, it's so dumb. And he's an inherent heel. You can feel it off him. He's like Shane, same kind of thing. He just has that I'm being, screwed by everybody all the time, thing going on that Shane does. It's just, they're both two people. You're like, if you're in the room too long, it's like, oh, just get me out of here. Yeah, if he's at the party, you're like, okay, can we go now? Enough of this.
You know what? I've been around Tom Zenk, and he is. He wasn't a bad guy. He was fun to be around, but he was so naturally arrogant that, that's who he should have been. And no one took advantage of it. I was saying this before I met the guy, and when I met the guy, it just confirmed everything I felt about him, that if you just let him be himself, and, he's like the high school quarterback who doesn't think he could get any girl in the school. He knows it. And just let him be that.
But that's Philadelphia booking. That's why it worked. Because he brought in a guy that he knew Philadelphia was. Actually, he had proof of it because they booed him out of the building a couple of years earlier. So, he knew he was going to be a heel. Because Philly fans don't forget. Okay, if they hated you, they're going to hate you again. And that's going to stand it. Okay, here's my favorite Philadelphia angle, because I knew this was for the Philadelphia fans. Do you remember how they got Bill Alfonso over to begin with?
Yeah, they made him the referee that was actually going to enforce the rules.
He enforced the rules. He became an instant heel.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. He's going to be the referee who, doesn't let these guys throw punches and hit each other in the face with chairs. There are rules out there that need to be adhered to, so you're right.
I remember one was Axel and Ian Rotten. They were having this Singapore Taipei laser, beams, whatever, something taped to our fingers match, whatever stupid match we're having this time. And it was 15 seconds in. I think Ian got this Lex Luger trickle coming out of his head, and Alfonso stops the match. That was the greatest ending ever.
Bill Alfonso was his character in ECW. At some point, it was really funny, especially when he was out there with Taz, and he suddenly would start yelling all these threats, and then he stopped and he looked scared, and he looks at Taz and he goes, "Is anyone coming?" And Taz just goes, "Nah, no one's coming." And he just started up right again. But he was funny, but he could be annoying in the wrong way. Like when they gave him that whistle and he would just start chanting, "Who will stop the path of rage?" I did not want to see that.
But yeah, he was again, the early days of Taz were really good. You had to turn Taz face eventually because he just got so over as a heel. But you know, again, that was a specific thing with there. And okay, Philly was probably the home of the original smart fans, right? Quote, smart fans.
Philly in the 80s was by far the smartest city out there because they had a well listened to radio program run by Joel Goodhart. And I mean, Joel's a good guy, I like him, but he would basically read the Observer on the air. And his counter to that was, hey, news is news, you know, and if I happen to be reading it out of the Observer, okay, but that's why they were so well informed.
That tells me you have an audience.
If you
can just sit there and read a publication on air and you have people listening to you, that tells me you have an audience. You know,
I mean that show that Joel Goodhart was running shows based on his radio show.
Another dazzling businessman. So you had the original smart fan. So what does Paul do? He runs one angle after another that basically makes fun of the smart fan. You know, you put Mikey Whipwreck over, which, you know, no one thought that was coming. You know, just to mess with the people. You know, again, he did this too much, and it became ridiculous at the end. Another one was the famous Shane Douglas pitbull angle.
Oh, yeah.
Where Gary Wolf broke his neck. And
yeah,
they
and
did the whole thing.
By the halo.
Yeah. And all the key there was even the heels came out and yelled at Shane. So that messed all the fans up because they're like, wait a minute, was that real? They momentarily messed with you. Okay, you kind of brought it together after a while, but they messed with you a little bit. But that was because it was a Philly audience.
No, I'll never forget that. Like, you know, the looks. I remember watching this late night on Channel 27, and Shane grabs the guy and starts tossing him around by this halo, and everyone's jaw dropped. My jaw dropped. I'm like, how do you even do that?
But if you did that same thing in, say, you know, Calgary or something, you're going to be off the air.
Yes.
Immediately. You know, old Ed Whalen, you know, he's not going to stand for that. You know, God forbid that people be entertained.
I bet it would have gone over a lot of places. I bet it would have gone over in Memphis. I bet it would have gotten over in Florida. In Georgia, I don't know. But, you know, Mid-Atlantic, I don't know. But there are a couple of places, like, I could see in the 80s a promotion doing it and everyone going, like, you know, holy crap.
But you can specifically book your area to that audience. So you could establish, again, I'm not sitting there, you know, if you're sitting at home going, you know what, this is how I'm going to make $1 million. Because I think it was Jim Cornette's line. He goes, you know how you walk away from the wrestling business with $5 million? You start with 10.
Yes.
Okay. It has to be, who was it? Rick Rubin?
Yes.
It has to be something like that. It has to be a guy who was just a fan. You know what? Break even. It would have to be, that's what I'm saying. Smoky Mountain is pretty much the template. But again, that's just a tough area because you just don't have a lot of disposable income in that area. I mean, God bless them. Those are they're the best fans. He was right as far as that goes. They were going to show up. But I think if he tried it, maybe like in the Carolinas or Western Tennessee, you have better luck.
Here's the thing though. Jim Cornette, who ran Smoky Mountain Wrestling for 4 years, he had someone, here's the thing. He lost Rick Rubin as a money man, as an investor. The promotion, you could tell the promotion really took a blow when that happened. The television production, the production of the television show went down sharply. And I'm not even someone who has an eye for that, someone who looks for that, but you could tell they were cutting corners and cutting costs. Now, Jim Cornette, after that 4-year run, said his exact quote, he had someone who was willing to invest in the product, and Jim told him, nope, save your money. The territories are never going to work again. Now, maybe he was saying that because in part because the Monday Night Wars were in full swing, and that was at least in part keeping fans out of his arenas. But I mean, that was his quote. They're just not going to work anymore. Now, does Jim Cornette know everything? He knows a lot, but not everything.
Yeah.
But even he, tapped out. He didn't think it was a possibility.
I just think it's a tough area. I think if you do that in Western Tennessee, because you yourself said how crazy those Louisville crowds were.
Yeah. At the same time, Louisville had a hot crowd for a while, but eventually the promotion went out of business in part because people stopped coming to Louisville. They stopped coming to Memphis, Evansville, etc., Nashville.
Because that early 90 Nashville, Memphis product wasn't, that was a national product. Everyone everyone did the same stuff. Everyone, started doing either national or ECW. And there's so many other things you can do. Just look at some of the promotions they had back in the day. That was the beauty of the territory system. Like we were saying before, was that you had so many different types of wrestling. I mean, you just had like the straight up wrestling in Florida. You'd have kind of the hybrid in the Carolinas and Georgia. You'd have the circus show in Memphis. You'd have the whole
all over the place. I mean, Memphis did something very unique in 1992 when they brought in the Moondogs and they turned everything. It was basically Lawler and Jeff Jarrett against the Moondogs, and they were doing FMW style stuff on television. And my understanding is that crowds went up a little bit at first, but even something as unique and something as fun to watch on tape as Lawler versus the Moondogs really didn't long-term translate into box office.
I still think they got too violent with that, but okay. Where did FMW get their act from? Let's put it this way. Who was the founder of FMW?
Onita. And Onita went through...
Who had extensive exposure where?
In Memphis, and especially during the Tupelo Concessions brawl they had there.
Yep, he was in part two.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the second one, so was it okay? He was in one of them. I know that, but he was in one of those brawls, and he has an extensive experience in there. He was in the tag team during what I would consider the heyday, which was kind of that 80 to 82 area. I just think no one does it correctly because no one will cater the product. Cornette's the closest. Because he came in with a game plan. He's like, I can get these territories and these towns by doing this. That's just a tough economy to do it in that area.
Yeah, I mean, it's – and I'm not, saying this derisively against you, obviously. But it's one thing to say, okay, you got to do it right. You have people on the internet who's like, okay, well, how should you run a promotion? Well, you should have excellent, interesting characters, and you should have dynamic storylines, and you should – okay, well, what are those dynamic storylines exactly?
Yeah, but you can't do that. Where are you going to have this organization first? That's what I got to know. Because I put it is going to depend on what I do. Because that's the whole thing you're trying to do is cater it to the area. There's where you're going to succeed.
Maybe. I mean, I'm looking at it this way. Like, let's say, all right, well, it's Memphis. And Memphis has a rich wrestling history. So we're going to build more on that. Okay, well, who's the Memphis character? Are you going to try to recreate Lawler? I hope not.
No, obviously not, because that'd be an insult. But yes, you would need... I wouldn't say Lawler, but you would need kind of an anti-hero. Because the anti-hero babyface has always worked in Memphis. Whether it is Fargo, whether it was Lawler, that's the thing that worked. Was the babyface. It really was the babyface.
I like what you just said, because I think that is the one thing that wrestling is lacking today. They don't understand that it is the anti-hero that works out. When I say wrestling today, I'm talking about the WWF. Their top guy for the past 10 years has been John Cena, who is, the babyface, the straight-laced guy. There's nothing at all rebellious about John Cena. And one thing that they do, if they have a hot heel who is over and who the fans are responding to in that role, they like this person, they're waiting for that person to turn, they immediately whitewash that person. I mean, Roman Reigns is not the same guy that he was as a heel, and the fans get the sense that he's being forced down their throat, so they're rejecting him.
Because it's a national product. So you can't run, unless your name is Steve Austin, and that was a special case. That hit them so hard, they didn't know what to do with it once that really started to take off. That wasn't one of those things where they're like, we're going to make him a superstar. No, it didn't work out that way. But an anti-hero is a tough sell nationally.
I don't know why. The Rock was also an anti-hero type babyface.
But he was so funny, he got away with it.
Yes, I was going to say, he had so much charisma, and he was The Rock.
Again, he was. It doesn't work because what's an anti-hero here is not going to be an anti-hero there. So you have to.
And one thing I got to throw in, and you know, you and I need to wrap it up pretty soon, but you got to remember that the average wrestling fan in Memphis now is not, for every person who grew up watching the show on WMC, there are how many, 10, 20, 30, who grew up watching wrestling on USA Network. They remember The Rock, they remember Stone Cold, they remember Kurt Angle, John Cena.
Yeah, and the product isn't as good.
It isn't. I mean, I loved, not everyone does, I loved late 90s, early 2000s WWF.
Yep. I agree.
And they watered it down, and no one likes it as much anymore. And
so
you went for that, maybe.
You have a bunch of fans who are like the old, like the way it was a few years ago, and are drifting away. There's your opportunity.
Yeah, it's a possibility, but Sean, this has been an interesting conversation. I did not think that, you know, we were going to talk about this for an hour, but there was more than an hour worth to discuss. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. That was fun.
Yeah, definitely. This has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Network. Thank you all very much for listening. Sean, thank you for coming on.
Ah, pleasure. Thank you.
Be good, everyone.